All right, welcome everybody to another deep dive. Today we're taking a look at something that I think a lot of people have heard of but probably don't quite understand.
Yes.
And it's this idea of adverse possession.
Yes.
I think a lot of people think they understand it. They're like, oh yeah, I've heard of squatter's rights. If you just live on somebody's property long enough, you get to own it.
Right.
But there's a lot more nuance to this than a lot of people realize. And it's super interesting, and it really gets to the heart of property rights and how we think about property law. So where do you even want to begin with this?
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that it's codified. So in Rhode Island, it's under Section 34.7(1) of the Rhode Island General Laws.
Okay.
And so it's not like a nebulous thing. It's something that's actually set out in the law.
Right.
And yeah, like you said, it's got all these sort of interesting twists and turns.
Yeah.
And in today's deep dive, we're going to take a look at a case. It's called Martin O. V. King. It's a 1978 case out of Rhode Island. And it gets one of the more tricky aspects of adverse possession, which is hostility.
Okay.
And the best way to think about it is if someone, you know, let's say you let someone borrow your favorite book.
Right.
Can that person just decide one day, oh, this is mine now?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So, like, how can it be considered hostile if it started with permission?
That's exactly right. And so our mission today is to figure out if long-term occupancy that began with, you know, sort of a friendly nod from the actual owner can somehow turn into an adverse possession situation.
That's a great question. And that is really counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of people. So, all right, let's jump right in. Let's talk about Martin O. V. King. So what was this case even about? Like, give me the basic facts. What are we talking about?
Sure. So let's set the stage. We're back in 1936 in Smithfield, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Nora King. She gets the title, becomes the legal owner to 22 acres of land. It's a decent chunk of property.
That's a good amount.
And she wasn't alone. She had her brothers, Charles and Fred, living with her on the property. And then later, Frank joined them as well.
Oh, wow. So it was kind of like a family compound almost.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. There wasn't any formal agreement, like a lease.
Oh, interesting.
Or anything in writing about why they were there. It was really just family living together.
Mm-hmm.
And the court, when this case eventually went to court, they labeled this as permissive use. It's like when you stay at a relative's house for a while, there's an understanding.
Right, right, right.
But not necessarily a legally binding contract.
Yeah, yeah. It's totally understood, but there's nothing written down, nothing formal.
Exactly.
Interesting. So, okay, so they're all living together. Everything's fine. What happens next?
Well, about 10 years later, in 1946, Nora King passes away. And she dies intestate, which is a fancy legal term for saying without a will.
Okay.
So you would think at this point, things might change. Maybe the brothers would move out or something would happen with the property. But no, they just kept living on the land.
They just stayed there.
They stayed put.
Ah.
And this is where our story of adverse possession really gets interesting.
Okay.
They kept living there, Charles, Fred, and Frank. But they also started doing things like paying the property taxes.
Okay.
And then, get this, in 1951, Frank builds a second house on the property.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's a pretty big deal, right?
Yeah.
Building a whole house.
You'd think that that would give them some kind of claim, right?
You would think. But here's the really interesting thing. Despite living there, you know, for decades, paying taxes, even building a house, the court eventually said they never explicitly claimed ownership. There were no recorded deeds, no official letters saying, hey, this is ours now. Nothing like that.
So wait, it's almost like they were just these long-term guests who never actually said, hey, we're taking over.
Exactly. And on the flip side, Nora's heirs, the people who legally should have inherited the property, they had no idea that they even owned this land until 1968.
Oh, wow. So for like over 20 years, the brothers are just living their lives and the actual owners are completely oblivious.
It's pretty wild. And this is what sets up the legal battle, right?
Yeah, it's totally.
When the heirs finally figure things out.
So 1968 rolls around, the heirs finally realize, wait a second, we own this place. And then boom, legal battle, right?
That's right. And to understand why the court ruled the way it did, we need to break down adverse possession law in Rhode Island.
All right. Yeah, that's probably a good place to start.
Because as we've hinted at, there are certain things you absolutely have to prove to win an adverse possession claim.
Okay. Lay it on me. What do we need to know?
Think of it like a checklist. 7 specific things, all of which have to be true for at least 10 continuous years. You miss one, and your claim falls apart.
All right, so 10 years is the magic number. What are the seven things?
Number one, you have to have actual possession, meaning you're physically living on the property.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
Number two, it has to be open and notorious. It can't be a secret. It's got to be obvious you're living there.
Gotcha. So like hiding in the basement wouldn't count.
Not exactly. You got to be living openly, like any typical owner would.
Okay, so open and notorious. Check. What's next on the list?
Number three, and this is a big one, hostile.
Oh, God.
And that's what we're really going to dig into today.
Yeah, because that's the tricky one, right?
It is, especially in a case like Martineau. But basically, it means you're acting like you own the property. You're using it in a way that contradicts the true owner's rights.
Okay, I get it. So it's not about being mean or aggressive. It's about acting like the owner, even if you technically aren't.
Exactly. And then number four is under claim of right. You have to honestly believe you have a right to be there, even if that belief turns out to be mistaken.
So even if you're wrong, you have to think you're right. That's interesting.
It is. Then we have continuous, number five. You can't have significant breaks in your occupancy, 10 years straight or pretty darn close to it.
No popping in and out. Got it. Okay, what else?
Number six, exclusive, meaning you're not sharing possession with the real owner or the general public. It's your place and nobody else's.
Makes sense. So you're not just like camping out there every once in a while. It's your primary residence.
Right. You're treating it like a true owner would.
Yeah.
And finally, number seven, it has to be for the required period of time, which in Rhode Island, like we said, is 10 years.
Okay, so we've got our checklist. Actual, open, notorious, hostile, under claim of right, continuous, exclusive, and for at least 10 years.
You got it. And in Martineau, hostile was the element the court really zeroed in on.
Okay, so let's unpack hostility a bit more, because like you said, it can be pretty confusing. You hear hostile, you think of like arguing or fighting, but it sounds like legally it means something different.
Totally different. Legally hostile just means you're occupying the land in a way that says, this is mine, without the real owner's permission. You're acting contrary to their ownership.
Okay, so like putting up no trespassing signs, even though it's not your land, that kind of thing.
That could be an example, yeah. But here's a really important legal concept that the Martineau court emphasized. If you initially had permission to be on the land, like in the case of the King brothers, the law assumes it stays permissive unless there's super clear evidence that something changed and you took over the land in a hostile way.
So because Nora initially said, hey, brothers, come live with me, the court's looking for a specific moment where they went from guests to hostile occupiers, right?
Exactly. The court wanted to see, did they clearly switch from being there with Nora's blessing to claiming the land against her rights, or later, the rights of her heirs?
And is that where things get tricky with this case?
That's exactly where it gets tricky. And the court really looked at what the brothers didn't do. They didn't put up any fences to mark their territory.
Oh, interesting.
They didn't send any formal letters declaring, hey, this is our property.
So no clear, this is mine now statement.
Nope. And no documented instance of them telling anyone, we own this place. They were very silent about ownership.
It's like they were living their lives, but not making a fuss about owning the land.
Right. And legally speaking, that silence didn't help their case.
But what about Frank building that second house in 1951? You'd think that'd be a pretty strong sign, right?
You would think so. But the court looked at the context. Frank built the house, sure, but he lived in it while his brother Charles was still living in the original house until Charles died in 1959. There's no evidence Frank ever said to Charles, his own brother, hey, I'm claiming this whole property now. It's like, within a family living situation, building a house could just be building a house. It wasn't necessarily a hostile act against shared ownership.
It's like, hey, we need more space, so I'm building another house, not kid out, this is all mine now.
Exactly. The court saw it as ambiguous. It didn't clearly shout, hostile takeover.
Okay, so even building a house wasn't enough. But let's talk timelines, because we know 10 years is super important for adverse possession. Let's say, for argument's sake, Frank building the second house in 51 was the start of a hostile claim.
Okay, let's play that out.
10 years from 51 would take us to 1961, right?
Right. But remember, Frank moved to Florida in 1968.
Oh, right. So even if we were generous and said the hostile claim started in 51, he didn't stay there for the full 10 years. he left early.
Exactly. And continuous possession for that whole 10-year period is a must. You can't just disappear for a few years and still claim address possession.
The clock has to keep ticking without interruption.
That's right.
And we can't forget that the heirs didn't even know they owned the property until 1968. So how can you claim the brothers were acting hostily towards the owners if the owners didn't even know they were owners?
That's a great point. It's like trying to tell someone their house has a leaky roof when they don't even realize they own the house. For adverse possession to work, the true owner has to be aware, or at least have a reasonable opportunity to become aware, that someone else is claiming their land.
Right. Otherwise, how could they possibly defend their rights?
Exactly. The law wants to be fair. It wants to give property owners a chance to fight back if someone's trying to take their land.
So, after all this back and forth, all these details, what did the Rhode Island Supreme Court ultimately decide in Martineau v. King?
The court sided with the trial court and ruled that the King brothers had not proven adverse possession. They didn't meet all the requirements.
And that came down to hostility, right? They just couldn't prove that they were truly acting as hostile possessors.
That's right. And their initial permission from Nora was a big factor. The court basically said, if you start out on a property with the owner's permission, it stays that way. Unless you do something really clear and unmistakable to show you're no longer a guest, you're now claiming the property as your own.
Like explicitly saying, I own this now, or something equally dramatic.
Exactly. Something that leaves no doubt. The court used the term unequivocal act. It's got to be undeniable.
Okay, so no sneaky takeovers allowed.
Right. And paying property taxes and living there, when you were initially allowed to be there, that doesn't automatically make you a hostile possessor.
So you can't just quietly pay the bills and hope to become the owner. You have to actually claim the land openly and clearly.
That's the big takeaway from Martineau. And this case built upon another Rhode Island case, Finocchiaro v. Francesco.
Oh, interesting. Another Rhode Island case.
Yep. And that case also emphasized the need for super clear evidence of hostile intent. You can't just be a silent squatter. You got to make it very obvious to the real owner that you're claiming their land as your own.
So the key is, it's not enough to just be there. You have to act like the owner and you have to make it known.
Exactly. And you have to do it in a way that would reasonably alert the true owner that their property rights are being challenged.
Okay, so let's play a hypothetical to really hammer this home. Let's rewind to 1959.
Okay, back in time we go.
Frank builds that second house. But this time, he also puts up a massive, obvious fence around the entire 22 acres.
Okay, a fence. That changes things.
And then he sends a certified letter to every single one of Nora's potential heirs he can find, stating in no uncertain terms, this land is mine. I am the owner.
Whoa. Okay. Now he's making a statement.
In that scenario, would the court see that as hostile?
That's a great hypothetical. And in that case, those actions, the fence and the letter, would likely be seen as the kind of unequivocal acts the court's looking for.
Right, because the fence shows he's excluding everyone else, and the letter directly tells the potential owners, I'm taking over.
Exactly. He's no longer silently occupying the land. He's making a clear and open claim of ownership.
But even then, the 10-year rule still matters, right? Frank moved to Florida in 1968.
Absolutely. The 10-year clock is non-negotiable. Even with the fence and the letter, if he doesn't stay there for the full 10 years, he's not meeting the requirements for adverse possession.
Right. The clock can't stop and start. It has to run continuously for the whole 10 years.
Exactly. And your hypothetical also brings up that crucial issue of notice to the owners. Even with the fence and the letter, if the heirs in the real Martineau case were still unaware of their ownership until 1968, it makes you wonder if the 10 years would even start counting until they knew they owned the property.
Right, because how can you make a hostile claim against someone if they don't even know they have something to claim?
And as we mentioned earlier, Rhode Island law requires actual notice, not just constructive notice. That means the owners have to actually know about the hostile claim, not just that they should have known if they'd been paying more attention.
So ignorance of ownership on the part of the true owners can really complicate things in an adverse possession case.
It definitely can. And ultimately, the law is trying to strike a balance. It wants to protect the rights of property owners, but also recognize that if someone's been openly and continuously occupying land for a long time, acting like the owner, there might be a legitimate claim there.
So it's not just about being there. It's about being there openly, continuously, and hostily for a set period of time and making sure the real owner is aware of what's going on.
You got it. And that's why Martineau v. King is such a fascinating case. It really highlights the complexity of adverse possession. and shows how the courts carefully examine all the details to make sure justice is served.
Yeah. So for all our law student listeners out there, Martineau v. King is a must read if you really want to understand the ins and outs of adverse possession. And it shows that proving hostility is a big hurdle, especially when you started out on the property with the owner's permission.
Absolutely. That initial permission can really throw a wrench in things unless you take clear and deliberate steps to say, I'm no longer a guest. This land is mine.
And Martineau makes it clear that the courts aren't just going to hand over ownership to someone who is initially a welcome guest. They want to see clear and convincing evidence of a hostile takeover.
It's a great reminder that so-called squatter's rights aren't as simple as they might seem. There's a lot more to it legally.
So as you're pondering all this, think about this.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of actions beyond just living on the land and paying taxes would truly show a hostile intent when you're originally allowed to be there? It's a great question to consider if you want to dive deeper into the nuances of property law and adverse possession. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Thanks for having me.